Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, January 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. At the top of the front page, we have the headline, Iowa Caucuses See Dip in Turnout. This is reported by Benjamin Fisher. The first in the nation, Iowa Republican caucuses saw less drop-off in local counties from the record-setting 2016 than did the state as a whole. Precincts also generally saw more support for former President Donald Trump than other primary candidates. Ahead of Monday's caucuses, the Republican Party of Iowa was using 2016's record statewide turnout of 186,932, the last time Trump had serious primary competition, as a goal. When the dust settled, the unofficial reported, turnout was 110,298 statewide, 41% fewer participants than in 2016. Turnout in Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, and Jackson counties also was lower than in 2016, but by less than the statewide drop. Monday night's sub-zero temperatures and Trump's lead in the polls have been proposed as reasons for the drop in participation. Local counties also supported Trump over other candidates, and often by greater margins than statewide. Loras College political science professor Chris Butzes said Wednesday that Iowa Republicans would need to investigate the drop-off in caucus participation ahead of the general election in November. If you're the Republican Party of Iowa, your concern is less who was there at the caucuses and supported another candidate than Trump, the presumptive nominee, he said. Your concern is who did not show up to caucus, who wasn't there this year, but who was there in 2016 and why. As of Wednesday afternoon, 4,494 people had been counted as having participated in the Republican caucuses in local counties on Monday. 2,606 in Dubuque County, 692 in Jackson County, 671 in Clayton County, and 525 in Delaware County. Dubuque County GOP Chairman John Dara said Wednesday that he was grateful to all of those who had made it out and that he was pleased with the turnout given the weather. I am still trying to sort through all of the caucus forms, the new voter registration forms and everything, he said. It was pretty good. But turnout in area counties was significantly lower than the 2016 numbers. In Delaware County, 38.8% fewer Republicans participated. Other differences in participation were 29.2% fewer participants in Dubuque County, 19.9% fewer in Jackson County, and 13.8% fewer in Clayton County. Dara said he believes Monday night's sub-zero temperatures following two major snow events were major factors in decreased turnout. I would think that the weather would have had to be a factor, he said. Even now, driving on some of the streets is not the best. If anybody has concerns about mobility, I wouldn't blame them for sitting this year out. Jackson County GOP Chairwoman Darla Chapel said she had received calls indicating that the weather was most to blame. It was definitely weather because I had a lot of calls from people asking if they could do it absentee because of the weather, she said. Butz has shared many experts' skepticism regarding weather's impact. Could the weather have contributed? Maybe, but I put less stock in that, he said. With caucus goers, you're talking about people who are politically motivated. A cold night is unlikely to stop them. Butz's guessed it was more likely that missing caucus goers had been resigned to Trump's winning, whether they wanted him to or not. I do think that it also could be a notion that some believe it's a fait accompli, already decided, he said. And Trump ran his campaign that way, and he's the presumptive nominee. Trump exited the 2024 Iowa caucuses with a commanding lead of 51% support to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's 21.2%, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley's 19.1%, and businessman Vivek Ramaswamy's 7.7%. And Trump won in local counties as well. In three area counties, his share of support was greater than statewide. He had 72% support in Jackson County, 63.8% in Clayton County, and 55.6% in Delaware County. Only in Dubuque County did Trump have less support, 47.7%, than statewide. Chapel said she was not surprised by Trump's big numbers in Jackson County. "Of people I knew in Jackson County, by far the majority were for Trump," she said. "And there were more from when Trump visited in the summer. The turnout for that was crazy. Some pockets of rural areas had high Trump support in particular. 68% around McGregor and Marquette in Clayton County, 72.6% around Delhi in Delaware and Delaware County, more than 80% in four of Maquoketa's five wards, and 74% in Farley and Worthington. Trump did not win all area precincts. However, he tied DeSantis in two area precincts, Piastas in Delaware County and Elkaters in Clayton County. And Trump lost to DeSantis in two area precincts, Key West's precinct in Dubuque County and Colesburg's in Delaware County. Tristan Edwards of Piasta brought her 8-year-old son, Colton, to the caucuses. She said she planned to caucus for Trump largely because of his strong stance on security at the southern U.S. border and his record of expanding veterans' benefits while in office. "We know what we're getting with him," she said. "I think it's pretty black and white where he stands on things." DeSantis took second in Clayton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties, as he did statewide, earning 23.4% support in Delaware and Dubuque County, 18.6% in Clayton County, and 18.3% in Delaware County. Area precincts where DeSantis fared best tended to have older and wealthier populations or were rural with steady population growth. Haley took second in Jackson County with 10.8% over DeSantis's 9.8%. She also took second in 11 Dubuque County precincts, 6 in Delaware County, and 5 in Jackson County and 2 in Clayton County. Typically in rural county seats and areas where populations skew younger and higher educated, Ramaswamy did not make it to second place overall in any local counties and since has ended his campaign. He did have the second most support in numerous area precincts, however, 5 each in Dubuque and Jackson counties, 2 in Clayton County, and 1 in Delaware County. Precincts were where Ramaswamy did best shared one or more of three characteristics. Ones where Haley performed poorly, the top three non-Trump candidates fared the same, or that are areas around colleges. The article is accompanied by a picture of people gathering at a precinct caucus, and the caption says, "Precinct 32 Chair Philip Akronkovich holds up a presidential preference card during the caucuses in Piasta, Iowa on Monday." That picture was taken by Stephen Gassman. On the left side of the front page, we have a story by Elizabeth Kelsey, "Tri-State Schools Tracking Student Brain Health." From screening assessments to data tracking programs, local school districts employ a variety of methods to monitor the brain health of their students. A recent report from the Illinois State Board of Education, which examined the landscape of mental health screening services in schools, recommended that Illinois move towards universal mental health screenings of all K-12 public school students. While officials at several local schools said they currently do not screen all their students for brain health concerns, those from Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa alike said they use curricula, assessments, and relationship building to ensure students are supported socially and emotionally. "In terms of brain health and emotional health, I don't know that we're certified and qualified to make a detailed assessment for a student, but this starts the conversation toward finding out where the need lies and designing our instruction and activities to best meet the needs of our students," said Western Dubuque Community School District Superintendent Dan Butler. The Illinois report found that 27.8% of Illinois school districts conduct universal mental health or social emotional learning screenings for students, and 71% of districts use some form of mental health screenings. However, these screening activities vary by district size and geography. While more than 50% of districts in the Chicago metropolitan area utilize universal mental health screenings, more than half of the counties in the state, including Joe Davis County, have fewer than 1% of districts that do so. Ashley Martinez, a social worker in the East Dubuque, Illinois School District, said the district completes screenings and assessments for students who show high levels of concern, including those in the district's special education program, but officials have not implemented a universal screener. She feels the district would benefit from a universal model to better track students' needs and is confident staff would support it. But finding the community resources to help students who are identified on a screener is harder. If they're being identified on a screener, I think many times they're needing a service that can't be provided in a school, and in this town, there's not enough mental health resources to go around, she said. Our families have to drive long distances to access counseling or therapeutic interventions, which makes it difficult to dive into universal screening. Martinez's concerns were echoed by many districts in the statewide report. Among districts that reported no current screening activities, 62.6% cited a lack of access to mental health services in the community as a barrier to universal screenings. During the 2022-23 school year, all Dubuque Community School District elementary schools used a tool called the Social Academic and Emotional Barrier Risk Screener, SAEBRS, which addressed students' ability to work independently, cooperate with peers, adjust to setbacks, and more. However, a state law passed last year forbids Iowa school districts from giving students a survey, quote, designed to address the student's mental, emotional, or mental health that is not required by state or federal law, unquote, without receiving written consent from the parents. So, Director of Behavior and Learning Supports, Mimi Holsinger, said the Dubuque District eliminated the use of SAEBRS this year. While officials may seek parental permission to return to the survey at some point, Holsinger said the district feels staff time is better spent providing interventions based on other data, including teacher and parent referrals, behavioral reports such as the number of times a student has visited the principal's office, attendance data, and more. The screener has a unique piece of data, and I think we did enjoy having it, but we can find this data in other ways that help us lead to early intervention, she said. The Western Dubuque District obtained parental permission earlier this year to use SABRS, S-A-E-B-R-S, with all the elementary students, and Butler. She said the vast majority of parents gave permission for their children to participate. In the Platteville, Wisconsin School District, Director of Student Services Max Long said high schoolers typically complete the annual Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which shows school and grade level trends, and middle schoolers also occasionally complete social emotional learning surveys. Long said the district has considered implementing a universal brain health screening for all grades, but has not yet done so. Instead, staff use a data tracking program to monitor any behavioral incidents or concerns for each student. Potosi, Wisconsin School District students also complete the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. But because the data is confidential, it does not help the schools address a specific student's concerns, said social emotional learning coach Tiffany Helmke. With that in mind, she said, Potosi middle and high schoolers this year, for the first time, took an assessment called the Brief Student Universal Report for Emotional Regulation, so staff could have, quote, more concrete information, unquote, about individual students' emotional needs. While staff hope that data will prove valuable, Helmke and other district leaders said building relationships with the students in their care often tells them more than a screener ever could. Even though we may not have a specific number or data point, we are having conversations with teachers all the time about how students are doing and making sure that they feel seen and heard and like they belong in schools, Hemke said. The article is accompanied by several pictures of those mentioned, Dan Butler, Mimi Holsinger, and Tiffany Helmke. And on the right-hand lower part of the front page, we have a large picture of a library looking down a row of stacks. And I'll read the caption after the article, but it's presented by John Cruz, and the headline, Library Eyes Multi-Phase Expansion, a proposed $13.1 million expansion of Carnegie Stout Public Library likely would be completed in phases over a decade or more, library officials told Dubuque City Council members this week. Officials with FEH Design said during a presentation to the council that the entirety of the project to expand and enhance the library space and offerings could be completed through a series of smaller improvements over a 10 to 15 year period. Officials said that strategy would make the overall project more financially feasible in the short term and also lead to more successful fundraising efforts. It might be a 10-year plan, said Kevin Iperly, president of FEH Design. It might be a 15-year plan. The first phase is probably within 3 years. The presentation marked the first time city council members officially were shown the library's proposed project, which library leadership began designing last year. The proposal, selected from among 16 options, would double the library's third floor space and provide additional areas primarily for staff, all-purpose meeting rooms, and administrative offices. Two structural protrusions on the northeast section of the building's second and third floors would provide additional space for conference rooms and quiet reading areas, and a redesigned first floor would include a new entrance on the east side of the building. Christy Monk, an architect with FEH Design and member of the library's Board of Trustees, said the addition of an east entrance would make the library more visible to the public, given that its current entrance is seen easily only by motorists heading south on Bluff Street. Library Director Nick Rossman told council members, the proposal is designed to meet the anticipated future needs of the library that include a growing collection, expanding programs, and increasing general library usage as the population of Dubuque continues to increase. Under the proposal, a redesigned first floor would include a new entrance on the east side of the campus library. Let me see. I'm reading captions here. In June, the city hired FEH Design for $40,000 to conduct a space needs assessment of the library based on the anticipated growth of both the population of Dubuque and the library's collection size. That assessment determined the library would need to expand its current square footage of 53,700 to 72,000 square feet to meet anticipated space needs over the next 20 years. While city council members were supportive of the proposal, they also stressed that the city is not currently in a position to immediately fund a $13.1 million project. However, they did support the idea of splitting the proposed improvements into phases. I think the idea that we are able to phase it is very appealing to me in order to wrap my head around a long-term goal, said Councilmember Katie Whittle. Grossman said library officials intend to identify potential funding sources for the project, including grants or a future fundraising campaign. Hyperly said the library likely will conduct a fundraising feasibility study to determine how much money the library could raise privately, which would help determine how many phases into which the project would need to be split. Whenever that first phase does occur, Rossman said, it likely would focus on expanding the library's study and program space, given the increasing demand for that type of space in the past few years. Rossman also asked council members to consider making library improvements one of the city's future priorities, which would pave the way for direct city funding. Council member Rick Jones said he believes the project should be considered as a potential city priority, but he stressed that there are only so many things the city can prioritize each year. And the article is accompanied by several pictures. As I mentioned, there's the large one, and I'll read the caption for that. It says the proposed $31.1 million expansion of Carnegie Stout Public Library in Dubuque would provide the library's third floor space, provide additional areas primarily for staff all-purpose meeting rooms and offices. Pictures taken by Stephen Gassman, and there's a picture of the exterior of the library, and it again reiterates the proposed program that is presented to the council. And now we turn to the opinion page, and we have two other view columns. The first is by Ann Dischler. Her titled column is, In Iowa and Nation, Children of Color Face Disparate Outcomes. And the author is Ann Dischler, Dischler, D-I-S-C-H-E-R, is Executive Director of Common Good Iowa, whose team of policy advocates, and analysts leverage reliable data, solid analysis, and collaborative relationships to craft policy solutions to Iowa's most pressing problems. Common Good Iowa's vision is a state where children and families are healthy and secure, workers thrive, and clean air and water contribute to a healthy future for all. And the Common Good has a website, which is CommonGoodIowa, all one word, .org. CommonGoodIowa.org. The column is by Ann Discher, D-I-S-C-H-E-R. And again, repeating the headline, In Iowa and Nation, Children of Color Face Disparate Outcomes. Children of color in Iowa fare at best modestly better than their peers nationwide, and far more poorly than their white Iowa peers, according to Annie E. Casey Foundation. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's 2024 Race for Results report. These findings reflect failure in Iowa and nationally to equip all children to succeed. Policy choices and lack of support for families result in particularly dire outcomes for Black, Latino, and American Indian or Alaska Native children. Children of color, representing one of every four children in the state, face significant barriers to opportunity, fewer opportunities to live and play in safety, to access affordable education from preschool to college and skills training to help make ends meet. All told, even white children in Iowa fare only slightly above the average for white children nationally, a level best described as top of the middle of the pack. For at least a decade, Iowa lawmakers have prioritized tax cuts disproportionately benefiting the wealthiest Iowans over supporting policies and programs that improve the well-being of children. It is time for a reordering of our priorities. The kids, all of them, are depending on us for a brighter future. The Race for Results Index standardizes scores across 12 indicators that represent well-being milestones from cradle to career, converting them into a scale ranging from 0 to 1,000 to make it easy to compare and see differences across states and racial and ethnic groups. Indicators are grouped into four areas: early childhood, education and early work experiences, family resources, and neighborhood context. Here are scores for Iowa and the U.S. average, along with Iowa's ranking among states for which data was available. Black or African American, Iowa, 403, 26th of 46 states, the U.S., 386. Hispanic or Latino, Iowa, 505, 12th of 50 states, the U.S., 452. American Indian or Alaskan Native, Iowa, 547, 7th of 31 states, U.S., 418. Two or more races, Iowa, 578, 26th of 50 states, the U.S., 612. Asian and Pacific Islanders, Iowa, 704, 30th of 35 states, U.S., 771. White, Iowa, 720, 18th of 50 states, U.S., 697. This report highlights the importance of disaggregating data by race and ethnicity. Iowans are used to seeing our state near the top of the list on similar studies. When we break down the numbers, we get a truer, if more alarming, picture of how we're doing as a state in meeting the needs of children, especially children of color. Nationally, Asian and Pacific Islander children have the highest index score at 771, followed by white children at 697 and children of two or more races at 612. Scores for Latino, 452, American Indian or Alaska Native, 418, and black children, 386, are considerably lower. Calculations of the index for all 50 states show that experiences vary widely depending on where a child lives, from a high of 877 for Asian and Pacific Islander children in New Jersey to a low of 180 for American Indian or Alaskan Native children in South Dakota. Young people are missing critical developmental milestones as a direct result of choices to fail to invest in policies, programs, and services that support children, especially in under-resourced communities and communities of color. The Casey Foundation introduced the Race for Results Index in a 2014 report and updated it in 2017. This third edition of the report carries data from the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic that demonstrate both the urgency of ensuring all children can thrive and the promise of policy prescriptions for achieving that goal. Race for Results contends that young people are missing critical developmental milestones as a direct result of choices to not invest in policies, programs, and services that support children, especially in under-resourced communities and communities of color. The Casey Foundation makes several recommendations in Race for Results toward improving outcomes for all children. And then there's a list of suggested policies. Congress should expand the federal child tax credit. The temporary pandemic-era expansion of the tax credit lifted 2.1 million children out of poverty, with the share of kids in poverty falling to 5.2% in 2021, the lowest rate on record. States and Congress should expand the earned income tax credit. Lawmakers should consider baby bonds and children's savings accounts, programs that contribute public funds to dedicated accounts to help families save for their children's future. Policymakers must create targeted programs and policies that can close well-being gaps for young people of color, because universal policies are important but insufficient for continued progress. And then there's the summary of what I just read before, and it says the 2024 Race for Results report is available at the website www.aecf.org. The Common Good Iowa website is Common Good Iowa, all one word, commongoodiowa.org. And the author of this report was Ann Disher, who is a direct executive director of Common Good Iowa. And later on, we'll get back to the other view column, which was presented by Arthur Sear. His column is headlined, "Taiwan Reaffirms Equality Democracy." That'll come later on. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, January 18th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. And we'll read first the list of brief funeral service announcements alphabetically. William J. Ammann, A-H-M-A-N-N, William J. Ammann, Naples, Florida, Celebration of Life, 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, January 20, the Best Western Hotel, 3100 Dodge Street, 20 Highway 20 West. Marilyn R. Althoff, Earlville, Iowa. Visitation, 9 to 10 a.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Earlville. John E. Bartles, Moore, Oklahoma. Visitation, 9 to 10:30 a.m., Friday, January 19th, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Service, 11 a.m., Friday, St. Francis Xavier's Basilica, Dyersville. Robert J. Breitfelder, Dubuque. Visitation, 1 to 4 p.m., Sunday, January 21st, Hoffman, Snyder, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory on Asbury Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Monday, January 22nd, St. Donatus, Iowa. That's at the St. Donatus Catholic Church. Shirley I. Dock, D-A-A-C-K, Shirley I. Dock, Dubuque, Celebration of Life, 1 to 4, 1 to 6 p.m., with a time for sharing, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, January 20, Happy's Place. John W. Dias, D-Y-A-S, John W. Dias, Andrew, Iowa. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19, Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue. Service, 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20, St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church, Springbrook. Christopher J. Hermson, Janesville, Wisconsin. Visitation, 9 a.m. to noon, Saturday, January 20. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory, Lancaster. Service, noon, Saturday, at the funeral home. Linda M. Hertenstein, Guttenberg, Iowa. Visitation, 10 to 11:30 a.m., Saturday, January 27, St. John Lutheran Church, Bellevue. Service, 11:30 a.m., Saturday, at the church. Kenneth L. Hoffman, Dubuque. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. today, Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home on John F. Kennedy Road. Service, 10:30 a.m., Friday, January 19, at the funeral home. Noel E. Kurt, Dubuque, Parish Wake Service, 3 p.m., followed by visitation until 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Friday, January 19, Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Mary K. Lawrence, Benton, Wisconsin, visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. today, Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, Wisconsin, and 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, January 19, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Benton, Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Charlie Reeson, Dubuque, visitation, 1 to 3:30 p.m. Friday, January 19, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, prayer service, 3:30 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. Ardo A. Schmidt, Preston, Iowa. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, January 20, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Preston. Service, 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Shirley M. Sheehan, Dubuque. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19, Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. And Charles E. Severdine, Dubuque. Visitation, 9 to 10:30 a.m. today. Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue, Iowa. Service, 11 a.m. today. St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Bellevue. And that concludes the list of our shorter funeral service notices. And now among our regular obituaries, we have Joan M. Feldman, 84, of Rickardsville, Iowa, passed away Monday, January 15th, at Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. on Friday, January 19th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue Saturday morning at St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church in Balltown, 9 to 10:15 a.m. prior to the funeral mass, which will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, January 20th, at St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church in Balltown, Iowa, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Tyler Raymond will officiate in lieu of flowers. Donations can be made to the Sherrill Volunteer Fire Department in Sherrill, Iowa, and LaSalle Catholic School, Holy Cross, Iowa, the Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville assisting the family, and information is available at its website, kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of the Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, Iowa, and that is for Joan M. Feldman of Rickardsville, Iowa. Stephen E. Anderegg, A-N-D-E-R-E-G-G, Stephen E. Anderegg, age 73, of Guttenberg, Iowa, passed away Sunday, January 14th, at his home. Visitation, 1 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, January 21, at Morris Funeral Home, Guttenberg. Visitation will continue from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to funeral services at United Methodist Church, Guttenberg. Funeral services will commence at 11 a.m. on Monday, January 22nd, at United Methodist Church, Guttenberg. Interment will be held at a later date. Pastor Neil Hofer will officiate. The Morris Funeral Home, Guttenberg, is assisting the family. Information is available at the Morris Funeral Home's website. Memorials may be sent to the Morris Funeral Home in Guttenberg. That is for Stephen E. Anderegg of Guttenberg. Robert L. Bob Mullican, 78, of Prairie du Chien, died on Tuesday, January 16. Visitation, 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 20, at St. John Catholic Church, Prairie du Chien. A mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will take place in Calvary Cemetery in Prairie du Chien. The Garrity Funeral Home of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family of Robert J. Mullican of Prairie du Chien. Harold Potter, 83, of Hanover, died on Monday, January 15. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 19, at Law Jones Funeral Home in Hanover, from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, January 20, at Hanover United Methodist Church, where services will follow. The burial will follow in Log Church Cemetery, Hanover. That's for Harold Potter, 83, of Hanover. Cecil W. Pierce, that's P-E-A-R-C-E, Cecil W. Pierce, 85, of Hazel Green, died on Monday, January 15. Visitation, 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, January 20, at Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, where services will follow. Burial will take place at a later date for Cecil W. Pierce of Hazel Green. Mary Alice Stallings, 79, of Savannah, Illinois, died on Sunday, January 14. Celebration of life will take place 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, January 28, at Manny's Pizza in Savannah. The Law Jones Funeral Home of Savannah is assisting the family of Mary Alice Stallings. Sandra J. Sandy Schulte, 53, of Waterloo, died on Saturday, January 13. Private funeral services were held. Burial will take place at a later date in Linwood Cemetery. The Bear Funeral Home on Main Street is assisting the family. For Sandra J. Sandy Schulte, 53, of Waterloo. Frederick L. Fred Kohler, 87, of Sherrill, died on Tuesday, January 16. Private services will be held. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family, And that funeral home is on John F. Kennedy Road. The family, they're assisting the family of Frederick L. Kohler, K-O-E-H-L-E-R, of Sherrill, Iowa. And that concludes the list of today's obituaries. And now we turn to the sports page for Thursday's Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week. It's Jessica Morgan of Lancaster. The headline of the article, Morgan Beginning to Torch Nets for Flying Arrows. This is reported by Shannon Mum. Jessica Morgan has gotten into quite the groove for the Lancaster Flying Arrows recently. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week scored more points than her opponent with a career-high 31-point effort in a 49-24 win over River Valley last week. The junior guard went 7-for-13 from behind the arc for 21 of the points. We have really relied on Jessica to be our main scorer this season, Lancaster basketball coach Courtney Feller said. She has a great court presence and the ability to take control of the game. We want the ball in her hands. In the Arrows' last five games, Morgan has averaged 24.6 points per game and is shooting 61.8% from the field. She is averaging 18.2 points per game through 11 games. I feel like I've gotten a lot more aggressive since my freshman year, and I'm stronger with the ball, Morgan said. Playing AAU basketball during the off-season has helped my game out a lot, and I feel more confident being a leader this season. In the past five games, Morgan scored 26 points against Benton, 22 against Richland Center, 25 against East Dubuque, 19 against Prairie du Chien, and 31 against River Valley. She has the ability to score inside and out, and she's just super competitive, Feller said. This year, we moved her to the point guard spot for the first time in her career, and she's taken on that role very well. We needed her to take the ball up the floor with her calming presence and leadership that she brings to the court. Morgan said that teams have started to key on her defensively. Teams notice where I am, and I have started to double on me, she said. When that happens, I'm usually able to find the open girl. I will still try to get to the rim if I can, but I know someone should be open somewhere. Added Feller, teams definitely recognize the scoring threat that she has become, but Jessica is not afraid to take them on one-on-one. She has really turned the corner these past few games and has shown she can score anywhere on the floor. Morgan, who has played for Wisconsin Elite for 3 years, said AAU competition has helped her elevate her game. The teams you play against are not like any of the teams we see around here, she said. It has helped me in so many ways, both offensively and defensively. Feller is excited to see Morgan's game continue to improve. Knowing she is only a junior is pretty great as a coach, she said. We are thrilled to know we will get to continue to watch her game develop. The article is accompanied by a picture of Player of the Week, Jessica Morgan of Lancaster. Looks like she's making a drive toward the basket against a defender. The picture is taken by Shannon Mum of the Telegraph Herald, who is also the author of the article. And we have a second girls basketball story reported by Danny Miller. Kay reaches 1,000 points. It wasn't a matter of it, but when. Mother Nature, though, kept delaying the inevitable. Finally, on Tuesday night, Dubuque Hempstead's senior scoring machine, Camden Kay, reached her milestone. In the second quarter of Tuesday's 49-38 Mississippi Valley Conference victory at Cedar Rapids Jefferson, Kay became just the second girls basketball player in school history to record 1,000 career points. She finished the contest with a team-best 18 points and now has 1,012 for her career. A 16-point performance at Cedar Rapids Kennedy on January 5th left Kay just 6 points shy of the milestone. Torrential snowfall, however, wiped out the Mustangs' following two games. I was getting really anxious, Kay said. It was good to get it over with. I was a little nervous at the beginning of the game because they were face-guarding me, so I was like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? But as the game went on, it was like, okay, I got this. Kay most certainly would have eclipsed the barrier at her home gym on January 9 or January 12 had Mother Nature not intervened. Still, she received a nice ovation from the Jefferson fans and the Mustang faithful who made the trip. I was kind of bummed that I wasn't able to do it at home, but the coaches at Jefferson were nice enough to stop the game for a second, and everyone clapped for me, and they announced it, so that was really cool, Kay said. It even made it even more special that the milestone came during the Hempstead's fourth victory of the season, doubling their win total from a year ago. That was really cool because the past few years our record hasn't been the best, but we went in there with confidence, and my teammates knew it was probably going to happen for me, so there was just all this energy in it. It was just an overall great experience, Kay said. Throughout her journey as a four-year starter, Kay has been a part of just 18 wins as the Mustangs try and resurrect the program. She has been a leader since day one, an immeasurable trait that's being passed on to a roster filled with underclassmen. I hope it shows my teammates that hard work pays off, Kay said. The more you work as a team, the better the outcome will be. The past few years, I feel like it was more an individual game, but now it's becoming more of a team thing. I hope that sticks with the freshmen and shows them that if we stick together as a team and have confidence in each other, we're going to do better. There's a picture of the 1,000-point scorer, Camden Kay. And that was reported by Daddy Miller. She plays for Dubuque Hempstead. And now we return to the opinion page for the Other View column by Arthur Sear. His headline, Taiwan Reaffirms Equality Democracy. And Arthur Sear is a regular columnist. His last name is spelled C-Y-R. And he is the author of After the Cold War. And so his column goes this way. Over the weekend, Lei Ching-te, also known as William Lei, was elected president of Taiwan. He succeeds President Tsai Ing-wen, who served two terms and is the first woman to hold this top government position. This result continues significant political complications with mainland China. The Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, has won three presidential elections in a row. The party is formally committed to independence from China. However, Mr. Lei's vote margin was reduced, and the DPP also lost their legislative majority. The conservative Kuomintang, KMT, gained the most seats. This could be a diplomatic plus, given their more pragmatic approach to Beijing. Beijing is not happy about continued DPP control of the executive office, but greater KMT presence in the legislature proves opportunities for cultivation. China media have been relatively restrained about this election result compared to past extreme rhetoric. Both sides likely will continue to avoid armed conflict. The first DPP government from 2000 to 2008 was able to finesse the political challenges with Beijing. Today, economic concerns remain more important than ideological purity for China's struggling communist leadership. In 2016, the Taipei Economic Cultural Office, TECO, in Chicago, which represents Taiwan, hosted a remarkably instructive, insightful seminar on the implications of the return of the DPP to governing power. There was general agreement President Xi had effectively endorsed the framework of cooperation initiated by Beijing and Taipei in 1992. This remains true despite her 2019 speech that emphasized independence. One seminar participant suggested emphasizing the Chinese people globally, a primary source of overseas investment. This was remarkably shrewd, insightful suggestion, still worth consideration by government leaders in Taiwan. The two sides share a bitter legacy of battle and blood. In 1949, nationalist forces of General Chiang Kai-shek evacuated to Taiwan. Mao Zedong's armies controlled the mainland of China. Except for the island territory, communist revolution was complete. The Korean War of 1950-1953 made the Cold War global, with China and the United States direct combatants. U.S. commitment to Taiwan security became explicit. The foundation of cooperation has been built steadily, if slowly, over time. Pragmatism characterizes Taiwan's approach to mainland China. Following formal U.S. diplomatic recognition of Beijing in 1978, a consequence of President Richard Nixon's 1972 visit, Taipei immediately launched a comprehensive, non-confrontational strategic response. In November 2008, agreement was reached on far-reaching trade accords, including direct shipping, expansion of weekly passenger flights from 36 to 108, and introduction of up to 60 cargo flights per month. In 2010, the Bilateral Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, ECFA, was concluded. This has been a major triumph for then-President Ma Ying-jeou. His election as chief executive in 2008 and 2012 greatly furthered a rapprochement with Beijing. In February 2014, senior representatives of the island and the mainland agreed to exchange representative offices. Face-to-face negotiations were led by Vice Foreign Minister Shan Jiyong of China and Taiwan Mainland Affairs Minister Wang Yuqi. Unfortunately, in 2016, Beijing suspended direct communications. Taiwan has become an essential investor for the economic revolution on the mainland. Commercially successful, generally well-educated overseas Chinese, in turn, are a vital source of capital for the mainland. Expatriate Chinese also vote in Taiwan elections. Presidents Chi Chai and Nan Lai represent equality, fairness, and progress. Open competitive markets undercut rigidities of tradition and ideology. The ECFA framework is now so strong that a return to earlier hostility across the Taiwan Strait is unlikely. Taiwan, without doubt, has now effectively embraced representative democracy. And that's the column reported and presented by Arthur I. Sear, the author of After the Cold War. And finally, the weather forecast for tomorrow is mostly cloudy and frigid, with a high of 4 degrees and a low of minus 9. The wind will come from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Thursday, January 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.